Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
BTOs, Tolder.
Alright, I'm going to give Mackie another minute or two, and then I'm actually going to phone her and see what's going on.
See, I've been after Mackie's phone numbers for years.
Okay, John, I'll give you the number.
5675309.
Don't listen to that. 555-555-5554.
Oh, that's where I was going wrong.
Yeah.
G'day, everyone. Welcome to Polycast episode 102. Joining me today with a brand new shiny computer, it's Daniel Quick.
Triple digits.
Also joining us, taking his hands off the keyboard and his gaming mouse, it's the Mean Team.
Cheese tactics for the win.
And taking a head out of the clouds and thinking, which tactic should I use today? It's Lisa Bang.
Hey, what's up?
Also with us, and she's just got a pot of coffee beside the computer. She keeps one everywhere in each room. It's Makalua.
I think I need to change my username to Macchiato because that's what I'm fueled by today.
And also all the way from Europe, we have a special guest. It's Solver.
Hello, kids.
And I'm BT Oz, and I'm happy to be back again on Polycast.
Movies for Seven, started by Thorburn, who was a guest on episode, most recently episode 99, and he has a short list in no particular order of 300, Rome, the HBO BBC series, so I don't know, it's really a movie, Saving Private Ryan, The Last Samurai, In Harm's Way, and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah, dude.
Which, my eyebrow kind of went, I did kind of a Spock eyebrow.
He likes the Scooby snacks, too.
Along with the Scooby-Doo. So, there's an image. There's an image, Spock and Scooby-Doo. I managed to link those two characters together. Nice. What other movies or even just television series in general could we extend that to, other than the ones that were already mentioned?
Gladiator, if you feel like Rome.
Yeah?
Rome is awesome. It's amazing. It's my favorite series ever.
Ben-Hur?
Oh, Ben-Hur, huh?
The Cheaters on Showtime? That's pretty good.
There were two Elizabeth movies. Apocalypto is also mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Inglourious Basterds. Oh, no, just kidding, someone says.
Someone's also talking about The Patriot.
Mel Gibson, before he went nuts.
Oh, Troy.
Oh, yeah, Troy.
Yes.
Lawrence of Arabia. Pearl Harbor. Blackadder back and forth. Oh, funny.
That's just good general watching.
Hunt for the Red October.
Ooh.
Ooh, hey.
That's still very good.
I haven't thought of a movie in a long time.
We'll encourage you to actually try and build submarines.
There is a movie of Find an Ironclad in the Desert about 200 years later. It's called Sahara.
Oh.
And it came out in 2005.
Oh, I know. We forgot to mention Independence Day.
That's a mod.
Isn't that a better smack movie?
Yeah. Or Indiana Jones. Those are all good.
In forum talk, we discussed the ins and outs of the best Axeman unique unit replacements, whether or not you should ever use archery, and when, Civ 4 as a tool for teaching young children world destruction, and 150 Diplomatic Nightmares, the halfway there edition.
And with that, we discussed which was more useful, the woodsman or the guerrilla promotion line.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
This topic is by I Am, and asking, what do you think is the best Axeman? Of course, it has a lovely poll right on top of it. So the four options were, you know, basic Axeman is fine. The Phalanx, which gets 5 base, which is the same as the regular Axeman. and also has an additional 100% defense against Chariot. The Vulture, which is 6 base strength and plus 25% versus melee units, which is worse than base Axemen, and the Dog Soldier, which is Native American, which comes with 4 base strength but does not require bronze or iron, 100% versus melee units. I think most people here chose the Vulture.
Now this poll, unlike some of the others, were just ridiculous things won, like the Dyke winning the unique building poll, where I want to bash my face through the wall. Yeah, I actually agree with the winning results on this poll. I also feel the Vulture is the best of the Axemen uniques.
Yeah, the extra point of strength makes a lot of difference.
Yes, and the melee penalty isn't as bad as it looks at first glance. Like on Flatland, you will lose to an axe straight up. You're not, like, totally gimped, but once you start factoring in any kind of defensive bonuses, either on your side or on the enemy side, like, say they're in a city, suddenly the Vulture's better even against axes than a stock axe would be because of how the base strength works in this game. So, actually, the Vulture winds up being better than an axe by significant margin in really most practical situations, which is very useful if you're actually going to pull a rush early in the game or try to defend against one, I suppose.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I really hate the melee penalty, but also when I think about phalanxes, I'm also factoring in the fact I often play as allies if I'm playing Greek. I don't think I voted in that poll, but I would have chosen phalanx.
I've got this mental block. When I think of phalanx, I think of a spearman unit replacement. I mean, really, but okay.
Well, it used to be. And it was better when it was, incidentally. Well, the concept of using an axe as a superior melee is kind of ridiculous anyway. I mean, spears really dominated those kinds of battles back then. But oh well.
For reasons already said, I think Vulture comes out on top. What I actually found interesting, I find it in my notes here, was some side discussion about basic Axeman versus Dog Soldier. As Lisa had said in summary, but I'm now going to phrase it a different way, you get double the combat percentage against melee units, but you go down in base strength by 1, but then you also don't have to have copper or iron, which I think that's Dog Soldier's quote-unquote best trait, although really if you don't have copper or iron near you, you can probably pretty soon settle for it. I would actually rather go with the basic Axeman. We're going to limit the discussion to that because, as I said, I think that's the more interesting part.
Well, Phil should know because those Dog Soldiers, they should remind him of the Zerg because they don't need any resources and you can just build a hellish amount of them.
They're pretty bad for being cost-effective, though. Like, they are terrible against archers. The one thing that draws me to them, though, is that if somebody else lacks any strategic resources, especially horse, they're really annoying when they choke. It's hard to deal with them, and they can come pretty quickly since the Native American guy knows he can reach them right away. So they have that going for them. Obviously, if somebody neglects archery, they're toast because warriors are useless against them for the most part. Just the fact that you have them tends to steer people away from you in multiplayer, because you're not going to melee rush Native America, and it's hard to chariot rush Native America too, because they have city garrison 2 or even 3 archers. So it's really a bit of a pain to go after them, and that psychological effect is nice as well. I mean, you could just mop any incoming melee without effort.
Even if you're playing unrestricted leaders and then you don't necessarily have that archery bonus, it's always fun when you do unrestricted leaders and then they end up being restricted anyway. But even without that, I think the Dog Soldier would benefit if perhaps it was a little cheaper to build. Not a great benefit, but I think it would help. Actually, the first thing I thought of when I was looking at this thread and it was comparing all 4 of them, I was like, oh, they all cost 35 hammers.
Yeah. Although if you make it much cheaper, you start getting into the realm of having it be a little bit too dangerous of a unit to go with the other uniques that the Civ has. For example, the Malanese Skirmisher is just ridiculous, and something else that's so good against melee in particular, it would be hard to defend the Dog Soldier if it became too cheap.
Yes, anything below 30 hammers would be crazy.
Also, don't forget that a Native America, even without traits at all, can hit City Garrison 2 with their archery because of their unique building. So they are really difficult to rush, no matter what.
Let's go hypothetical. Vultures now cost 50 hammers instead of 35.
Give me the Phalanx, then. Or the Dog Soldier, for that matter. They're costing more than Praetorians. They are not Praetorians. I'll pass.
I don't know. I feel like none of them are that great. Maybe because Axemen is so good already.
I don't know. I've seen some Deity Mera cheesing over in the Hall of Fame where the Vulture did quite well against all other units. So if you want to abuse Marathon, there you go. Excellent unit for it.
So if you're trying to determine also what is the best Axeman replacement, not only think about what you would like to play, but what you would like to see the least against you. So in other words, do you curse more and more loudly if you see a Vulture, a Phalanx, or a Dog Soldier?
They're all pretty bad. I'd rather see the Dog Soldier, though, because Sitting Bull's no war product, Cautious, is the nicest in the game. And he'll poison your water, but he usually won't kill you. Seeing, like, Alex or Gilgamesh, on the other hand, is not ideal.
Alex is just psychotic.
Yeah.
It could be worse. You have no Copper Orion near you.
That's true.
And then you want the Dog Soldiers.
Yeah.
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 Although Protective Archers are not a bad fallback against the AI. They don't work too well when you get pillaged by humans, but AI will suicide into the cities. Archer EG Useit started by T. Middled, and he says, "Hi all, does anyone ever tech archery? I've been playing Emperor the last few games and still never tech it, other than once or twice. I've always managed to find iron or copper and go straight to superior units. Does anyone use archery, and how do they use it?"
Who are you people that don't use archery?
Sometimes you can get away with not teching it, depending on the map. Like, you can spawn bust any chances of barbarian trouble long before it shows up. That even happens on deity sometimes. So sometimes you can skip archery. But I would say for high levels where there's a lot of open space and you don't have copper or horse researched and you're on, say, Emperor Plus, you're running a risk if you don't go for archery, because you can get hit by multiple side barbarians in that case. It's also recommended early against the likes of Shaka and Tokugawa and anyone else who will attack you very early, like 1500 BC to 500 BC, because they're really superior defenders and they're all-purpose defenders. You put them on a hill and you don't have any better options, really. So it can be useful. Sometimes I'll just trade for it, though. It really is a game-to-game thing, but if you never get it, you're probably doing it wrong.
Yes, archers are very reliable. It's a good fail-safe. If you go archery, then you know you will be able to build that unit no matter what, and you know that it will do pretty well.
Yeah.
Especially if you just leave them in the city and build up their defenses and they can take care of themselves.
Unless you can stick them on a forested hill, a choke point of some kind, that's even better.
Yeah.
Then they could be obnoxious.
Yeah, you get a plus 125% defenses, 150% defenses on a forest hill if you just fortify for 5 turns. That's nonsense. You're well over 6 strength at that point. 7.5, actually. So really nothing in the early game could beat that then. It's the same thing inside cities, which give you the same defensive bonuses as forests do. So if you got a hill city, you can very quickly get up to over 7 strength without any promotions at all. Then you add promotions on top of that, and you're looking at 8 to 9 strength. They're just crazy if you're trying to wall off an early rush with them, and you can actually settle a hill city between yourself and the warmonger.
Yeah, because there was the one game we played on Saturday where I and Michael Lucas-Smith were working together and controlling this one city on a hill. I think Dan was one of the opponents, one of the ones we were actually fighting each other. And we kept this city on a hill forever because of the archers.
Was that the one where the great general saved the day or something? Or no?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that was before my time, but I've heard this.
So, yes, see, archers, very useful.
Actually, in that game, I think my partner was actually you, John.
Really?
Is Dan really implying that someone would be willing to be his ally?
I PA him sometimes when he gets a lot of land.
I am not implying, Solver. I am telling it as it is. I am beyond implying anything.
We will need documentary proof of that.
Usually I PA Lisa, though, because we get into a culture horror war.
It was mentioned in the thread. Another reason for archery being a prerequisite for a certain mounted unit that's in the name.
Yeah, horse archer.
That's always fun, actually. Sometimes you forget that. All right, let's go. All right, I've got horseback riding. All right, let's build. What the hell? God damn, game is broken. Son of a... Oh, I don't have archery right. That's always an amusing moment.
Yes. Horse archers are so fun below deity. You can just wipe so many cities with them.
And, of course, some people also mention that you can upgrade them to longbowmen once you get that wonderful feudalism technology.
Yep.
Even more obnoxiousness on the hill.
Especially if you've had that unit on that forested hill, and then when you have feudalism, you take it back and then upgrade it. Mm.
If feudalism offers some new BS, because you can put, with Acelage, Guerrilla 2 on longbows, and that's when things get really awful. You get instant plus 100% between the hill defense bonus, the 25% inherent bonus for the longbows on hills, and then another 50% for Guerrilla 2, and you move 2 spaces on hills. That is really, really annoying if you're in somebody's orders doing that. Not so good against AI, but against humans, 12 strength defensive units running around and threatening cities is not ideal. And also the fact that they can pillage your hills or, you know, even hit cities that are lightly garrisoned and burn them. That's a major problem, and they're hard to get rid of, and they're hard to maneuver around. So definitely use for it there.
And also unique unit situations.
Malinese. The bowman's pretty terrible, but the skirmisher is ridiculous. So yeah, absolutely go archery if you can abuse skirmishers.
So it's exactly what you said earlier. If you don't get archery at some point, you're doing it wrong.
Also, crossbows can be useful. If you can deny your opponent horse or iron and they can't build knights, crossbows will beat everything on the field until muskets. It's a long way away, usually, compared to when crossbows are available. So that's yet another option that's fairly viable.
But you can either, if you have tech trading on, you could trade for it, or if you left it long enough, it's going to be a pretty cheap backfill.
Yeah,
and once you have metal hooked up and hunting, you can't build warriors anymore, so they also become your cheapest hereditary royal garrison. So there's that as well.
For as an educational tool. There's a link in the topic to an article in Melbourne Metropolitan Newspaper about them using it to educate primary school kids. And I'm not going to try this guy's username because it's letters and a bunch of numbers.
Yeah, he's a piece of hardware.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Random Hardware started this and also put an interesting poll there up at the top. All sorts of options. I love that there's one here that says, "Say what? It's educational. I'm Garrett. Aversion therapy works, man."
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Well, what are you teaching when you're playing Civ 4 or making other people play Civ 4?
You teach a little bit of history, I think. I remember when I first started playing, like, I would poke around the Civopedia a lot. You learn a lot that way. And I think I mentioned it before that it's better in world history because I played Civ a lot. Although I didn't really play it while I was doing my homework or anything. Games, like, I think can be a good teaching tool. I mean, I remember when I was in elementary school, I used to play this game called Pharaoh. I don't know if you've...
I do.
Oh, that was used in my school as an educational tool, and the teacher was just like, "Oh yeah, you can play it, you know, to learn more about the pharaohs." But then I ended up, you know, just playing it, like it's during free time.
Well, now you know why it took so long to build those huge pyramids.
Too many hammers. Yeah, see, the next time you play the drinking game Circle of Death and somebody picks an asinine topic like ancient cities, you are no longer screwed, because you just get to think about the capitals of most of the civilizations in this game, and you are set.
See, it's good for all age levels, from primary school to college.
Absolutely. All kinds of applications. It could also be used to teach game theory. Yeah, just put people on a really, really crowded continent and have the kids start warrior rushing each other and see who comes out on top. It should be a fun exercise, I think.
Or give them a custom scenario where it's 11 billion spearmen in one tank.
That's more to teach them ahead of time the troubles with random number generator, I think.
See? You're still learning.
You learn that the random number generator hates you. And you learn it young. It's a good lesson to learn young, I suppose.
It is.
Some people are like, "No, Civ 4 is an educational tool for history. Boo, boo, boo."
Yeah, they're saying go play Europa Universalis. And kids, at the level that they're talking about, there is no way they could get into that game.
No. There's a balance. I mean, yes, you want children to learn, but really, when they come away with an education, how much are they going to remember in terms of the content itself? Maybe 5%, maybe 10%. You want them to be able to understand the process. You want them to be able to analyze and think critically and decide, okay, is this worth it? Is it more likely to be that I'm going to get ahead or behind if I do this? That kind of thinking is really what you're trying to get at. And the history does come out of it, because at least talk about you jump into the Civopedia, and then hopefully you want to find out more. Or you then begin to wonder, I'm experiencing this in the game. I wonder if this is how people really experience that in quote-unquote real life. And so you could use Civ 4, I mean, like it says, as an educational tool. It's not Civ 4 as education, period.
I prefer light-bulbing that technology.
Please, everyone, note that Dan is a hopeless idealist who believes that education is actually capable of causing critical thinking.
The playing sims capable of causing critical thinking.
Doing well requires it. I don't know if it causes it, though.
You want to try to engage people, particularly young people, but not just anybody. If you can make it into a game and something that they're actually going to recognize, then it's kind of one of those situations. It's like, you know, with edutainment, I'm learning something.
Yeah.
Just don't tell them that. Just don't tell them they're actually learning something and you're good to go. No.
Especially if they're studying, for example, the Roman Empire, and you can show them with a specific Civ 4 map for playing the Romans and conquering the rest of Europe. The TAM mod. It's got a lot of good stuff in it, and it just concentrates on that era, on the classical era.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about content specific, you can have like a free-for-all game with some parameters, but actually having a specific scenario depending upon what era of history you're looking at, what it is that you're expecting students to demonstrate and produce and show you that you know, I think specific scenarios and or mods would help in that particular circumstance. I think what really surprised me more about this article was the age that they were gearing the game towards. We have seen it talked about in high schools and in colleges and universities before, but elementary age children, I mean 10 and 11 year olds.
They're smarter than you think.
I don't see why not. I could have done it at that age. I mean, I played Civ 2 at that age and could handle it, so I'm sure they can.
I'm not saying they can't. I mean, 7 and 8, like 13 and 14 year olds, but 10 and 11? Oh, hey, good for them.
My 5-year-old nephew's starting to be able to read. I bet within a year or two, if I actually got him interested in the game somehow, I could get him beating Noble. I bet.
Yeah, you should have him play with us.
Well, maybe our environment wouldn't be so good.
It's also kind of past his bedtime at this point.
It would be pretty impressive to end up cool that has a bunch of 8-year-olds. Each and every one of them wants to take over the world.
Well, yes, we have to make sure we keep them rooted in reality somehow. Random Piece of Hardware is ultimately asking, when a game becomes mainstream and ends up being used in schools as an educational tool, does it stop being fun to play? Which is an interesting angle that I've never seen anybody take before. Does it stop being fun to play? No.
No. Or if you're one of those people that, oh, it's mainstream now, I don't want to play it.
Now, it was recorded for the first pilot and released in Episode 7. We looked at the same topic. Well, I don't think it was Civ 4 specifically. It was just Civ in general as an educational tool. Automated Teller says, someone in Canada did this either for 3 or 4 some years ago. It's true. It was for early Canadian history, 1500s to the 1700s, and it was Civilization 3 based. And as a matter of fact, just won an award last year, even though that game has been out for a few years now. Kudos to them. I mean, the thread has some interesting comments. I think the ones that kind of had me going, what? A couple people, like John Falcon, 99977, says, haha, that's a good joke, right? And then BitPlayer said, if this is for real, then it is retarded. You're welcome to your opinion, but can you explain why you think it is quote-unquote retarded? He hasn't really elaborated on what he means by that. And I read that and I think you're just jealous you didn't get a chance to play Civ 4 when you were in school. And you know,
that's it right there.
I feel the same way.
I was about to say, all I got was Oregon Trail.
I didn't have that experience, but there was something called an ICON, which was a computer built specifically for use in schools, and it was actually created by the Ontario Ministry of Education. What the ICON was, workstation housed in a large steel case with a fully sized keyboard mounted slightly left of center, and it had a trackball mounted to the right, but it had no hard drive. Everything went to a central server.
Mainframe.
Yeah, mainframe. You had a dummy terminal. And there was software there. It was a 4-part game on Canadian history called The Bartlett Saga. And it was about...
It's about the West Wing?
The West Wing of Canada. Oh, I guess we could stretch it that way. Settling the prairies. You took on the role of, as kind of was implied, a Bartlett, and you were trying to settle and build a life for yourself and your family, and you had to deal with stuff like random events, like locusts. Why do I remember that? Anyway, so...
Even back then.
I know. Let's go to your happy place. It can be educational, and it can be fun. If people are already playing the game, then that's a benefit to not only that student, but the other students in the class and the teacher, because then the teacher doesn't have to be the only one that's an expert. And in fact, I guess maybe the only downside is you might go into the game knowing more than anybody else, but by the time the kids are done playing it, they know more than you. But that's okay. The real barrier to Civ 4 as an education tool, or any computer game as an educational tool, is, money. Let's talk about this briefly. I'm thinking in this topic on what other educational tools, like in terms of games that I've played, I think of the Icons and the Bartlett Saga, but I also think of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I haven't played that for years.
Me neither. I still have the deluxe edition of Where is Carmen Sandiego on my shelf in the original box, original documentation, original discs, everything. Seven Cities of Gold as well, and we know especially Seven Cities of Gold influenced a number of people who have been involved in Civilization's development, including Sid Meier himself. So, there we go. If we want the Civilization franchise to continue, we need more people, we need more students at an earlier age to be exposed to Civilization so they can help continue to make great games such as Civ. And perhaps something even better than Civ, dare I say.
There's things better than Civ?
I know.
It's 150 Civ diplomatic nightmares.
Started by CivNoob13, starts a thread describing what has been said in the diplomacy screen, and then what happens in-game. Trying to get up to 150. Peace Vassals was one of the first posts.
Oh, God, yes.
I would have said it if he didn't beat me to it.
I did not do a top 10 list for this, but if I did that, well, that should be number one, but I'd probably make it 9 or 10.
Yeah, anyway. You have no clue as to where number one should be. I think you do them in reverse order, honestly.
A lot of these posts were very detailed, game-specific and or Civ-specific, and I tried to move away from those. Any of those, otherwise it just kind of stuck out in the head. You know, like, oh yes, changing your religion to go along with the neighbor, but then they change their religion, and now you're a heathen and they declare war on you. That's nice. Anything to do with the Apostolic Palace, of course. Nihil Zero talks about having one tech trading partner on a continent of hostiles. AP Vote forces you to stop trading with him. 150 turns later, he or she is still brooding and refuses to talk. Now you have no tech trading partner. Just turn tech trading off, and then you're not going to have that issue. I'm glad I was able to solve that for you anytime. Terry's also talks about we request your aid in our crusade against Sitting Bull. You can just generalize that, crusade against X. You join in, and then the next turn, your ally declares peace with said Civ.
Yeah.
That's even better. I don't know. Sometimes that bothers me even more than the religious one that he mentioned earlier. ITG, who mentioned peace vassals, also talked about, we're doing fine on our own. I don't know if that's so much of a diplomatic nightmare, except that they'll say you're doing fine on your own to you, but then the next turn they vassalize themselves to somebody else.
Yep.
That's only half the story, we're doing fine on our own, when we're talking to you. And then, of course, John Falcon, 99977, says, being stuck inside a stretch of land, and Stalin, who is blocking the way out, is annoyed at you for no reason. Let's generalize that. You're starting a game, you just meet a Civ, and they're annoyed at you for your no reason, and a little later on, maybe you become their worst enemy, even though they don't know anybody else other than you.
Yeah, Darth Caesar's got a good one. Tokugawa next to you, and Monty next to you.
Warmonger sandwich is always fun.
Oh, boy.
Tokugawa is probably the single most frustrating leader in the game. He will never do anything. He will never trade. He will never say a good thing about you. He's just totally useless.
He's pretty easy to abuse if you give him a junk city, though.
Monty will be completely friendly with you, turn around and go, I hate you now, stab.
Yeah. You see, Toku, if you give him a city and get him to please, not only can you bribe him to attack anybody you want, but just by default, he won't declare on you because he hates everybody else more because he's such a dude that he hates everybody.
Yeah.
So just give him, like, one of those desert-only cities and, like, here, have this. And he's like, oh, please, you liberate our cities and our trade relations are fair. And that about takes care of Toku. Sometimes. I really don't like when the interface lies to me. I hate that, and I had to include that in this, because it just irks me to no end that the interface can lie to you about diplomatic dispositions.
Yeah, I saw that in your post. Have you really seen Plus 15?
Yes.
Yeah, it happens.
Yes, I've seen Plus 15. It's really easy. Like, say you have Suri, you have fair trade with him, you're in his favorite civic, and you share religion. You will easily hit Plus 15, even before you get the Plus 2 open borders or Years of Peace or any of that. Because you'll get, like, plus a huge amount for the religion and then plus a huge amount for the favorite civic. But it doesn't matter, because if you have, like, one civ as a vassal with which he's annoyed, all that friendly is wiped. And the game doesn't tell you that. The game just averages out the dispositions quietly. And then when he declares on you by surprise, well, hope you knew the code mechanics, because otherwise you are effed. So I really, really hate that, and that they left that in for this long.
Oh, okay. I've seen plus 10, the highest I've ever seen it with anybody, whether it's myself or somebody else or in between civs.
Yeah.
You can get over plus 20 potentially, but it's not easy to do.
My favorite post in here, which is, it's about civ diplomatic nightmares, but I don't think you can really blame the AI for this one, although I suppose you could. Monty, our pride demands a small gift. 2,100 gold, double exclamation points. Cat steps on keyboard, hits enter key. Lemon didn't know about autosaves yet and couldn't catch Cat to strangle him. Thanks, Lemon Merchant.
Poor Cat.
The whole "you nuked our friend with which we are at war," that really pisses me off, too.
Yeah.
They get into wars with somebody and they're cautious, so if you nuke the person that they're at war with, there, you nuke their friend. That's not cool. And then you can gift nukes to anybody with no penalty whatsoever at all.
Which is why I just nuke everyone when you can.
Here, you two that are warring each other, have a few nukes. Take care of the problem for me.
Technically, the AI considers it a unit gift, but it just values the unit gift so lowly that you won't even get worst enemy trade demerits for it by the time you're actually picking up nukes.
Mm. Yeah, because in real life, nobody gets diplomatic penalties for trading nuclear things.
No, not at all.
And then also in that thread, a few people try to put into a list in terms of reasons for Civ to love you or reasons for other Civs to quote-unquote hate your guts. What's interesting is he lists 13 reasons. The first person lists 13 reasons for why they hate your guts and then only lists four possible choices for reasons that they would love you and then talks about, isn't there some kind of disparity here? Well, as a couple of other people pointed out, you're missing a few. So there are actually 13 items listed for positive relations and 13 for negative relations. And after looking at both of those, I guess there was one other that someone mentioned about stuff with relation to colonies. Ooh, okay, count on one hand the number of times I ever saw colonies even be an issue in a particular game. Reasons for other civs to hate your guts. Heathen religion. Past events have shown your true nature to us. Oh, that actually the random event. Jeez, with that, I've grown at that. Our close borders spark tensions. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Refuse to help. Declare war. This war spoils our relationship. Yeah, don't get us started. Worried about our rivals serving as your vassals, trading with our worst enemies, negotiated an embargo, nuked us, raised cities, raised holy cities, and you caught one of our spies poking around in our territory. Reasons for them to love you, brothers and sisters of the faith, helped us. Past events have shown your good nature to us. Trade relationships fair, defensive pact, open borders, years of peace, shared war, favorite civic, gave us help, admire your civics, you liberated us. Something to do with colonies is something, I don't think there's anything that's been missed there in terms of what you actually see in-game.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Woodsman or Guerrilla promotion line. We have talked about a number of promotions and a few compared to each other in the past. For those interested, I'll just mention the numbers. 47, 48, 51, 58, 59, and 75. If you don't remember those numbers, then just repeat the last few seconds on an infinite loop. But we want Woodsman or Guerrilla promotion line. I think this thread was also started by IM, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Then he lists about Woodsman promotion line being available to Recon, 1 and 2, Melee and Gunpowder. Guerrilla promotion line available to Archery, Recon, Melee and Gunpowder. And then lists the three different promotions in terms of what they give you. He says that the Woodsman promotion line is slightly better in the early game when there are still lots of jungle and forest. In the long run, however, the Guerrilla line is tops. Guerrilla promotion line is available to archery units. Hills don't get cut down. And the 50% withdrawal chance with Guerrilla 3 is an underutilized promotion. Both of these promotion lines can give significant advantage to Monty, Brennus, and Boudica if utilized to the fullest. And then, of course, the question is, do you go down the Woodsman or the Guerrilla promotion line? Maybe in the long run, Guerrilla is tops, but the early game is so critical and much more inviting. I mean, imagine lots of jungle and forest. So I would be choosing the Woodsman line.
And you can also get a Woodsman 3 medic to run around if you're lucky.
Yeah, it's worth an extra 5% over medic one, I guess. I don't know. I don't find either of these promotions general purpose enough to actually bother picking between the two of them. They're both useful in the situations where you would actually take them, but outside of that, not so much. Maybe for archery, I'd like Guerrilla 2. I don't know. I mean, it's slightly better than City Garrison 2, I guess, but it doesn't make sense to me to compare them, really.
Well, and the poll includes fourth option as neither are useful, which, and there's also mixed both are useful, so I wouldn't say mixed both are useful. If you're forcing me to choose between Woodsman and Gorilla, then I will choose Woodsman, but well, he also has the option that neither are useful. Again, it's how it's phrased. I wouldn't choose neither, but I wouldn't say that neither are useful, so.
Hmm.
Well, let's just be clear, we're talking about Woodsman here. Are you talking about the jungle and forest defense? I would never bother really with Woodsman 3, but, you know, having a scout or even better, a warrior that's a Woodsman 2.
Woodsman 3 is great for Aztec because their Jaguars start with Woodsman 1. You can get Woodsman 3 at 5 experience.
Well, like you were saying, I would have just had Woodsman only for scouts and that. I wouldn't worry about any other units.
You could use it for chokes and maybe for Woodsman 3 medic with an aggressive sieve or something. It's all right.
I suppose if we want to get situational, though, if you're playing like a Highlands map, oh, you know, okay, Gorilla.
Yeah.
Towards like the Gorilla 2 double movement hills.
Gorilla's probably the better offensive option.
Oh, indeed.
Maybe even defensive. I don't know. It just depends where you are in the game.
And what your terrain is like.
Yeah, well, it's not going to be too useful without hills. But most people settle on hills, or at least have them in their territory. And you do want to block the opposing stack from getting on them, because it's a pain to abuse your collateral initiative against stacks that are on hills. It costs a lot more than it would on flatlands. So you can get a couple hill defenders to make it really not cost-effective for them to stay on the hills. That could be useful.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycasts in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
So is it still theoretically impossible for a Spearman to beat a tank? Because they went on the record saying that on a live show. They said that that was mathematically impossible until proven otherwise. And I'm just hoping we don't prove otherwise because of this.
This means the first thing we have to do when we get Civ 5 is open whatever its thing is the world builder, spawn a bunch of spearmen, spawn a bunch of tanks, start testing.
And then max unhappiness for one side.
Yes, max unhappiness on the tank side, see if that works.
Yeah, 2K and Fraxis kind of threw down the gauntlet with that statement. Like, oh, that's a challenge for the capital C. Oh.
Yeah, they wasted no time with that one.
The special mention should, of course, go to those guys who had to stand around all day at Gamescom dressed as civ leaders.
Really?
Yeah, paid students who, according to reports, knew next to nothing about the game, but they were pleasant.
I wonder if I could pull off dressing up as Shaka. No? Damn.
As long as I don't have to see it, Phil, you can do whatever you want.
Oh, no, I was going to say, he can't not have picks for that.
Civ meets can be really creepy. I mean, you just look at the pictures of those people visiting Gamescom and then you realize that you wouldn't want to be spending time with them.
And you see, that's why Polycast is able to continue, because next to nobody knows what we look like.
Exactly.
We're good.
The other reason we'll never do video.
Okay, well, I was looking at the other Gamescom coverage on Napolitan, and they have, like, a YouTube video of John Schaefer talking, and he's really cute.
Don't say that.
Why? It's true. He's like a cutie.
John has been getting a lot of rockstar treatment lately.
Hey, John.
All those videos and everything.
Oh, yeah, that's
well,
true.
He used to be one of us, now he works there. It's awesome.
So now, Lisa, can you at least wait until the game is finished before you approach John? Because we may never see or hear from him again, okay?
I never said I was going to approach him. I just watched the video, and, well, I don't, I'm not, yeah, anyway.
It's her celeb crush. You gotta let her have it.
Usually all these guys that create the games are such geeks, but hey, one that's half cute, alright.
Yeah, this one's cute.
Gotta love our female representation on the co-host panel here.
God.
Maybe it's like the camera equivalent of the Berkeley, what is it, plus two rule? Somebody's a seven, you have to add plus two if they're from Berkeley, or if they're a gamer.
We require more estrogen gas.
So, you know, maybe he's like a seven, and, well, okay, I'm not gonna...
No, not you, Phil. I heard that.
Wow, did you hear that, John? Lisa gave you a rating of 7 out of 100. That's
okay,
pretty harsh,
no.
Lisa.
Oh, man. But apparently that's good enough.
Poor Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa says something nice and...
I'm never going to compliment anyone again.
Careful, you'll compliment Tim and they'll start doing stuff with that.
Oh.
Thank you for listening to episode 102 of Polycast. This episode was brought to you by our eternal host, master, and owner, Daniel Quick.
As always.
The mean team.
My giant death road boss are taking the woodsman promotion.
Lisa Bang.
Bye.
Our adorable Maki.
Well, I'm going to take the All Your Bass Belong Jazz promotion, therefore I conquer all of you.
And today's guest hosts were BT Oz.
Bile.
Myself, Solar. And now I know who needs a date with John Schaefer, and I'll see what can be arranged.
Lisa says hi, John, if you're listening to this. She says hi, she's your biggest fan.
Just don't let my boyfriend hear about it, how about that?
No.
Oh.
An impressive intro. Good job. This one just stands out as better than the rest. That doesn't mean the others are bad, necessarily. It could just mean this one is that much better. It's all relative.
Oh, Lisa's right. You forgot to introduce yourself, John.
Oh, oops. Gee, I thought I did.
We take it back.
I did.
No.
Bummer.
So, I wanted to go to the best Axemen topic. Well, the reason I wanted to talk about this... Oh, wait. I should introduce it first. Okay.
You realized it.
Details.
What is a dog soldier?
Not as cool as a dog worker. But that's a reference to an earlier episode of the show.
Wait, what? Sorry, I just...
Lisa perks up.
What topic are we on right now?
I think I need to send her some of my coffee.
Yeah.
Does it pour through the internet? What?
Now, if you really want to abuse AI unit mechanics, you gift them a bunch of out-of-date units when they're fighting against somebody you don't want beating them. And they upgrade it for really cheap because they're AIs.
Oh.
And that will often win. And there's almost no diplomatic penalty for doing it. So if you want to give the AIs a bunch of crappy archers or warriors or something and watch them upgrade them into a bunch of axes and screw over other AIs just the way that they to screw you over when you fight them, magic longbows or rifles, yay, then yeah, that's the way to do it.
You're right. Gives you a chance.
I'm sorry, you're saying I'm right, but I'm not sure about what it is I'm right about, and I'd love to hear more about when I'm right, so please continue. It's a little-known fact that John gets a few coins deposited in his bank account every time he mentions Civ 5. Oh, sorry, John.
Whoops.
Oh, gee, you didn't have to tell everyone that, Dago.
That's okay, John. Nobody listens to this show.
Yeah. Good call.
Now, when you were asking Silver that question there, John, I heard some banging in the background. I think on Lisa's feed. Lisa, can you put John's picture up later? I mean, really, we're just trying to finish.
Oh. Okay. In the Senate, we discussed which promotion. Oh, okay. We'll do that. Okay.
Leave that one in.
All right.
As you can see, you know, when you listen to the episode, gems like we just had in the last few minutes here, that generally gets cut. And,
aww.
Well, some of it might be included in the bloopers, I don't know. It depends where on the crap-o-meter we are today. So that's right, I have a crap-o-meter.
Yeah.
Record date?
August 28, 2010.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.